He says I am a loser.
Worthless.
Unattractive.
Stupid.
Crazy.
Selfish.
Broken.
Ungrateful.
Damaged.
Frigid.
Unsupportive.
A bad wife.
A bad mother.
A bad daughter.
Nothing without him.
You don't have to let your partner's voice tell you who you are. If you are being abused, you can get help.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you this evening and every Saturday evening for enlightenment, education, and entertainment regarding the issues focusing on the aftermath of crime. So I want to welcome all of my guests across the nation, whether they are first time listeners or veteran listeners. We appreciate each and every one of you. And just want to let you know that if this is your first time, you have the opportunity of listening to this show repeatedly on our archives, as well as going to my website, DonnaGore.com, and Shattered Lives through the Inside Lens Network on Blog Talk Radio. And this evening, I'm very, very pleased to have two brand new guests, and I will tell you a little bit about them before I bring them on in just a minute. And I just want to say a brief thank you to our friend and colleague in Charlotte, Mike Sexton, for connecting me with our guests from High Point, North Carolina. And before I do, I want to say good evening to Delilah, my co-host, the person with the sparkling personality, and may I say an early happy birthday to you, Delilah, tomorrow. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for your lovely gifts, too. But this is really a show of great importance, in my opinion. I'm just always, as everybody knows out there in radio land, I was honored to work very closely with Susan Murphy Milano for several years through the development of the evidentiary abuse affidavit and through writing her book, Time's Up, and her last book, Holding My Hand Through Hell, which deals with a lot of the domestic violence issues that are still here. But it's just wonderful to me to see a program come through like the one that Chief Sumner is going to explain to us and to see the success of it, because one of the main points Susan and I talked about was over the last 20-some years, there was a lot of education and awareness about domestic violence stemming from the OJ case, but yet there weren't a lot of innovative ideas. There weren't a lot of programs developed that really made a difference, which is one of the things that, or one of the reasons that she worked so hard on the evidentiary abuse affidavit. So I'm really excited to welcome these guests and to impart to the listeners what an important program they have.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And you know, it as long as it's an innovative program and it's tested and it works, to me it doesn't matter that it's not totally victim focused. Whatever works that will decrease, stop the abuse, and you know, make sure that there are fewer victims and fewer crimes. I just take my hat off to anyone that's developing those. And I only wish in our state we were as innovative. Believe me, I've tried to impart messages, but that'll be a story for another day. So without further ado, thank you, Delilah, for that introduction, and I totally agree with you. And perhaps Susan is on her shoulder looking down from heaven. I'm sure she would very much appreciate this show. Chief Marty Sumner is a 30-year veteran of the High Point, North Carolina Police Department. He was appointed chief in 2012. He was the assistant chief, and he's worked in many other capacities, including major crime deterrence and prevention, patrol of vice and narcotics, detective training, and a number of other areas. And he helped as well to design another innovative program, the High Point Model Approach to Eliminating Neighborhood Drug Markets, which won the 2007 Innovators in American Government Award. And and another award in 2008 as well. So I think we have a very esteemed guest. He's very much on the cutting edge. And before we start, we also have joining us a victim services director, a profession close to my heart, as everyone knows, Shay Harger, who is the Victim Services Division Director at Family Services in the Piedmont, Guilford County, North Carolina. Some of the things that she does is she directs two 24/7 residential domestic violence shelters for women and children, including 24/7 DV and sexual assault victim advocacy program, a batterer intervention program, and there's also a supervised visitation and exchange program. She used to work in the children's advocacy capacity and has been in victim services for the last 10 years or so, and is very dedicated to her field as well. So Shay and Chief, I want to say welcome to Shattered Lives. It's a real pleasure to have you, and thank you so much for being with us on Shattered Lives this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's our pleasure, and, you know, we're so happy to have you here. Now, you know, we had put up some advanced posts regarding this, and I think maybe it's kind of like, you know, putting the shoe on the wrong foot, because when you first read about it, it's not something that you would necessarily think about in terms of the approach, is it, that you come from. And so I think to sort of give us a framework, Chief, would you like to talk about the evolution of this concept and how it was developed and by whom?
I sure can. Be happy to.
Okay. That'd be great.
About 2009, the previous chief and I, his name is Jim Faley, we're having a discussion. We're looking at our crime numbers, and the violent crime had been lowered dramatically over the years with some of these focused deterrent initiatives. However, that year, a third of our homicides were domestic-related. And Chief Faley came in my office one day and said, "What do you think we're going to focus on this year?" And I said, "Well, if we're not focused on domestic violence, we're looking at the wrong thing, because that's too much of our stats, and we really need to get zeroed in." And so we had had great success of working with David Kennedy, professor at John Jay College, and he was one of the ones involved with the Boston Gun Project, in which the focused deterrence work came out of. And so we called him up and said, "Have you thought about domestic violence? What would you advise us?" And he said, "Matter of fact, I have." He said, "I got a concept paper I wrote 2003, 6 years ago. I made a few presentations on it. It got distributed a little bit, but nobody really took us seriously." And he said the victim advocates really were not in favor of the approach. And so because we had such a great track record, a good partnership with David, he sent it to us, and we took a look at it. And we went from that concept paper starting in 2009 forward. So that was the genesis of why would we look at this. We were looking for something different because, like you say, I got a 30-year career, and really domestic violence, even though we've gotten more focused on it over the years, it really still a huge problem, and we really hadn't solved the problem. So we were looking for something that would solve the problem system-wide.
Wow, so you really were the first innovators. That's tremendous. Now, did you kind of do some kind of surveys with regard to the to, to the victim advocates and the and law enforcement there to say, what do you think? Or as the chief, did you say, well, we're going to do this and let's take a stab at it? Maybe poor choice of words. Let's try it.
Oh, no. We did convince ourselves that it was worth trying. After we looked at his paper, and his paper said, you know, I think these guys are going to have similar records to other chronic offenders. And it's not qualitatively different, as some believe. And he said, if that's true, then you will be able to put a deterrent regime into place that incrementally wraps up the sanctions. And the whole thing was, can we make the victim safer by controlling the offender? And that's what the first conversation was about. So we got a broad partnership together at the police department. We had victim advocates, we had service providers, we had district attorneys, both state and federal. We got David Kennedy himself to come down. We had Susan Herman here, and Susan Herman is probably a really well-known victim advocate. And she wrote a book called Parallel Justice for Victims. And she was here, and we sat in the room, literally put it up on the whiteboard, and we said, okay, here's what we think we can do. Everybody give us all the excuses. Why is domestic violence so persistent? And we were in there for about 20 minutes, and we wrote up everybody's comment. And it was pretty clear that every part of the system, the prosecutors, you know, well, I don't get enough cooperation from the victims, or the officers don't give me a good enough investigation, or the judges don't give enough sentence. Everybody had a perspective, and the victims had a perspective. You know, why should I come to court when the last time I came to court, the case was dismissed? So it's pretty clear to us that there was all these misunderstandings among each party. And David Kennedy asked the best question from the back room. He said, let me ask you guys something. Are those offenders resisting our best efforts? And everybody in the room said no. So we took a picture of the whiteboard, erased it, and said, we won't talk about that anymore. We're going to talk about what we can do.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by, how would you define that, from that question, your best efforts?
Well, what he was pointing out to us, that we had a lot of excuses up there why it persisted, but none of the people involved, none of the stakeholders had really sat down in a platform team like this and tried to look at where everybody could contribute from wherever they were. What could they bring to the table? And this was a really good moment for us, and that team has been meeting every 2 weeks since, and they're still innovating as I speak. They
really?
Figure
every
out,
2 weeks?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
And they, it was only in the beginning to put that together just to work out all the details of the initiative. However, it became so productive and so inclusive where they bring other partners in when they realize we've got a hole right here. You know, we don't know the victims that are going straight to the hospital, so we need a nursing supervisor here from the emergency room as part of the group. Every time we found a hole, they brought somebody else in, and the group continues to meet.
Wow, that's wonderful. So you identified all these, like, breakdowns in communication and, you know, like you say, you know, filling in the holes. And what was it like, Shay, from, I mean, were you in on this from the beginning? And what was it like from the victim advocacy perspective to hear this?
I was not in on it from the beginning. I was actually the coordinator of the Children's Advocacy Centers at that time, so I was getting some information about it. But what I did know with the information that I was getting is that I liked it. You know, from the victim point of view, it was the first time I'd had somebody say to me, the victim doesn't have to take responsibility for somebody else's behavior. And I was on board with that idea, and I think that innovative approach to it, to say that the victim doesn't have to do all the work to get this to happen, was the most intriguing part of this for me.
Yeah.
So when I assumed the director's position, it was an automatic fit for me. And I am on the team and do the meetings every 2 weeks, and he's very right about that. It's very innovating. That's a very living, breathing meeting, and it changes constantly. And when we do find a hole, or when we are able to uncover something that isn't quite clicking, everybody's quick to say, what can we do to fix it? And that's one of the exciting things to me about this initiative is that it is quite living and breathing and changing and evolving. There's nothing stagnant about it.
Maybe you can fill our listeners in just briefly about the so-called journey a victim takes step by step. You know, where is her first contact with law enforcement, the hospital, da-da-da, and what hoops has they had to go through in the past, and how this has impacted made a difference in the impact of what the victim doesn't have to do at this point?
Well, I think starting with the initial phone call of I'm in danger and law enforcement responds, you know, there's a time, and in some communities, law enforcement may or may not make an arrest when there is an assault. We have to go through the process of finding out who the primary aggressor is. You know, did this really happen? And as Chief Sumner has said and probably will say again, this is one of the largest amounts of phone calls that they will get. A lot of the dispatches they will be domestic violence. And so, you know, for law enforcement to respond to that over and over and over again, you know, will they make an arrest? So the victim is sort of left in that place of a question mark of what's going to happen if I do call law enforcement. So let's assume they do make an arrest, and so she's left with, where can I get a victim service provider? So she could call our crisis line. She could present at the emergency room. She could actually present at the police department. There's any number of places that she might present and say, hey, I need some help. And we would respond to that, and then we could help her walk through the domestic violence protection order process, which what that is basically it's a court order saying, you know, abuser, you need to stay away from this person. And I won't go into the details of the process of that, but it takes about 2 weeks to get that to happen. You have a ex parte hearing, and then they're going to set another court date out, and then that court date, the abuser and the victim are going to present. So that's stressful. You're making your case and telling what happened to the court in front of your abuser. So if you get that granted, that could be granted for a year. So now maybe he will abide by that, maybe he won't. If he was charged, how long will he be in jail? Will it be a 48-hour hold? Does he have other criminal charges where they might keep him in there a little longer? Was it a violent, super violent offense where, you know, they might keep him a little longer because the violence was up there? So there's a lot of areas. And then when it does get down to actually having to present to court because of an assault on a female charge, it's district court. There's a lot of people in that courtroom. You know, the abuser, it may be a month before that charge comes up on the docket. She has to go to court. She's going to have to be in front of the judge. He may or may not admit to it. So here she is telling her personal business in front of 200 people in a courtroom. So she may or may not present at court, like Chief Sumner said. It is quite difficult to get follow-through on that for all the reasons that anyone would expect. It's a lot of stress. He may have gotten to her and said, if you go to court, I'll kill you. I'll take the kids. Don't go to court. Baby, I love you. Whatever he said to her to get her to not go to court. And so a lot of times those charges get dismissed because, you know, you kind of have to have a victim in order to prosecute. And sure. I think that's part of this initiative that has changed a little bit too, is that we've been able to prosecute some cases where the victim piece of it is not quite as high as it has been in the past. So that's been one of the areas where I think the DA's office has really stepped up to the plate and law enforcement of making that solid case where the victim coming to court, yes, it's great, and yes, it does create an environment where it's easier to prosecute, but I think that's one of the missing links that we had for a long time. So now even after he's charged with this assault on a female, even if they have a restraining order, you know, you still got a lot of pressure of maybe he will abide by this restraining order, maybe he won't. There's a lot of pressure on the victim to present at court, to do the right thing. She may have to move out of her house. You know, she's got to put her kids in another school. There's just lots of things that the victim will have to take responsibility for, and we won't even get into child protection issues. Maybe a child protective service is involved, and they're saying if you go back to this person, we're going to take your children.
Take your child.
So there's many,
yeah.
many levels of issues there for the victim that she's having to navigate. So that's why we're here, is to help her navigate that.
All right. But by implementing this innovative program and focusing on the offender, would you say it takes at least, I'm just guessing, like 50% of that former responsibility off of her shoulders and makes the perpetrator a lot more accountable? Is that a fair statement, Chief?
That's exactly what we're trying to do, and that's what we've
yes.
been able to demonstrate in the last 2 years that we can do. We move
yeah.
all the responsibility and the burden off the victim, put it on the police, and
uh-huh.
everything is driven by us. From the first call, all the responsibility is us, and he has told that very clearly at each level
mm-hmm.
that
yes.
the police are driving it. And now the victim's input was very important on developing this. We actually did interviews in shelters, and we did some focus group work with the victims, and we asked them, you know what, law enforcement, we never really ask you, what would you want us to do? And most of the time the victim said, well, I just want him to stop. Anything that makes him stop, I don't necessarily want him arrested, I want him to stop. So we took that into consideration, but after we developed the strategy, the points,
mm-hmm.
after that, we relieve her of that. She can, and mm-hmm. the victims have told us, upon some of the notice that we've given offenders, and I do want to describe how that works.
Right.
But the yeah. victims have told us it changed at home, because here's another thing, law enforcement, we really wasn't getting. Most of the laws, the pro-arrest laws and things that are set up, those
mm-hmm.
presume that you're going to stay away from this person after the first
mm-hmm.
DV charge. That's not reality.
Mm-hmm. And that's not realistic, yeah.
No, it's not realistic.
It's not.
So it's better to control him rather than say there's no contact ordered, when you know that there is going to be contact. And the victims say, after you make it clear to him that there's going to be a real predictable consequence for him, and that's driven by police, not me, she
mm-hmm.
says, you know, I can call more often because I know something's going to be done. And he knows he can't threaten or intimidate or sweet-talk me to change it, which y'all do. And so it removes that burden from them, which has been, and that was one of our concepts to begin with. David
mm-hmm.
speculated on it. The system as it is put too much burden on her to remove herself from violent situations, and everything was about her unsupported in court and everything else. We totally flipped that. The only responsibility the victim has now is, number one, take advantage of all the services that are being offered, and there's a lot. Or
a relief.
Yes.
Really?
All she has to do is take advantage of the services,
mm-hmm.
and we will take care of everything else to do with the offender. And I made a presentation in North Carolina to the DV Commission, and one of the ladies there, after hearing the presentation, she says, now I finally get it. All of our services really wasn't working as effectively as they should have for the victim, because he was undoing it every night when she'd leave
mm-hmm.
counseling. He's undoing
mm-hmm.
it, the phone calls he makes and the things. She said, by y'all controlling the offender, now the victim can take more advantage of the services and they're going to be more effective. And that's
yeah.
what we've actually seen happen.
It makes perfect sense, you know. And can we say from the get-go then, but you kind of hand-select which people are going through this program. It's not every intimate partner offender that is eligible. Is that correct?
Right, correct. In the beginning, what we did some original research on 10 years of offenders, over 1,000.
Uh-huh.
And we looked at their criminal records, and it was really clear to us, something we hadn't realized before, there's prevention, intervention points, and there is a group that have three or more, and they're already convicted felons. These guys had rich criminal histories. They already averaged more than 6 offenses. That was another takeaway. This not really, for the most part, a secret crime. There are those that are unreported, but there was a lot that was reported. And so it was clear we had a group at the very top that were the most violent, and there was only 25 of those citywide, and their records were so bad that we said we're gonna do everything we can wherever they're exposed right now to immediately prosecute them and put them in jail as examples of what can be done.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end, the classified D is what happens on the very first call, even before any violence. This is a part where we in law enforcement hadn't taken much advantage at all. Most of our pro-arrest policies only kicked in after the first violent act. But we've said it's more important after the first call to document who the aggressor was, what was going on in that call, start laying that groundwork and that history. And our detectives will look at the calls from yesterday, and they will look at the guy's records that were involved in those calls. And if they have no previous charges, they get a letter and telling them they're on a watch list. And here's how the police department in High Point has changed how we respond to domestic violence, making sure he understands it's not up to the victim and making sure that she's already gotten some services offered at the same time. So from the first call and then a step up from that, there's a specific response upon the first arrest, the first charge. He gets notice before he even gets out of jail, and he gets his record review, and we tell him what kind of time he's exposed to right then. And that's another key piece. These offenders, the system had taught them there was really no consequence for this.
No consequence. So you have consequences all on every – like, can you kind of make up a scenario for us? Like, if you violate this, you're going to be incarcerated for, like, 2 years or – I mean, I don't know.
I got one example from this year that will show you how things are different. Okay, so in the old days, she makes a charge of assault on a female. As Shay said, it's a misdemeanor, and it languishes in court, and maybe he gets convicted. If he does, he doesn't get any time. And we know he'd been intimidating her, more than likely. So a gentleman by the last name of Hunt, in June, he got charged with assault on a female, misdemeanor charge. When we reviewed his record, we saw that he was eligible for habitual misdemeanor in this state because he already had 3 priors. That's a piece that we weren't doing before systematically. Then, since we're in contact with the victim and monitoring, we understand that he calls her from jail and threatens her and tries to intimidate her not to come to court. The district attorney indicted him for trying to interfere with the state's witness, which is a felony, and also charged him with another Class G felony. And so, let's see, in August, so little less than 2 months after the first just assault on a female charge, this person got indicted and got tried and entered a plea, and he received 31 to 47 months in the Department of Correction. And when he gets out, he'll get 9 months of post-release supervision. That's an example of how we can ramp it up and show these guys that we're not going to tolerate it, and we're all going to take up for the victim in every step. This is the kind of guy that I use as an example. When we go put the ones on notice after the first charge, we use examples like this and say, this can be you.
Mm-hmm. So prior to this, they had never been incarcerated for the other charges. I mean, they'd never been charged for these other actions that they had. Is that correct?
Well, the follow-up wasn't there. You get one charge, and it was, again, it was the victim's responsibility. But when we said, no, it's going to be ours, and now we're monitoring every single arrest and seeing what can be done and looking at his entire record, this is the things that we can do. And this gets the attention of others. This is the real thing that has really, really, really showed the most promise here. On all the levels I just described to you, I do want to talk just a second about that. We have already notified 1,024 men at different levels, from just getting a letter from one call to their first arrest. And I hadn't described to you the full face-to-face notification, which I would do want to do. We've already notified 1,024 in 2 years. Only 93 of those got a new domestic violence offense after being put on notice. That's 9% recidivism rate. Everything we find in the literature says even combinations of treatment and jail and probation and things like that are still double-digit, 20, sometimes 30%.
Up to 34, is that the right one, the typical rearrest?
Right. If we can actually control these offenders and prevent those next charges and only have a 9% recidivism rate, that is reducing the harm to the victims. The good news also is we know that it's not that the victims are not calling, because we still get repeat calls at addresses where we've put the men on notice, but when we go, there's no violence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's simply...
Wow. What does that initial letter say? I mean, do you just lay out the whole program with different levels? If this happens, this is your consequence. What does it say to put them on notice? That
it does, and we actually learned that from a study that was done in England over in Killingbeck in West Yorkshire back in the late 90s. They did a repeat victimization study, and all they did was go out the next day after a domestic violence call and put the gentleman on notice that he was on a watch list. And they did it for 1 year, and they were able to cut their calls by 50%. So mm-hmm. we looked at the language of their letters and adapted it for us. And it simply says, because you've been involved in a domestic-related call, I'm writing to let you know that the High Point Police Department is taking a new focused approach in preventing future acts. This letter is your official notice. Your name has been added to a watch list. The watch list will be reviewed daily by detectives and assigned to the Domestic Violence Task Force. We'll look at any complaint involving you as it relates. Any complaint. Any call, no matter where it's at. And we will consider complaints from any source, officers, neighbors, family, witness, victim, friend. And it says, and then we have to spell out what the crimes are. Crimes are threats, trespassing, damage to property, assaults, harassment, stalking. Because some of these offenders, they don't even know that all these other things are part of the violence cycle. So we just spell it mm-hmm. out for them in that letter. And mm-hmm. I say in here that it says Chief Summers ordered that this is our number one priority. And there might be unannounced police checks on your residence and any further act will be documented and reviewed in the task force. You need to know it's our policy to arrest offenders whenever possible, whenever
wow.
probable cause exists, and it is not dependent upon the victim.
Mm-hmm. Have you
now,
found that this has curbed the escalation that we often see, you know, from first offense, second offense, third offense? It's usually an escalation pattern
right.
that
mm-hmm.
has
exactly.
really helped in doing that.
It is, and that's why it's different levels, because what we were doing in the past, we treat every time somebody got arrested for domestic violence, we treat them all the same.
Mm-hmm.
But a gentleman who's only, if that's his first arrest, there's a certain level of notice and deterrent you can apply to that gentleman. The person's already violated protection orders and committed felonies. You can't treat him the same. So we had to recognize that there were three distinct levels of this cycle of violence. And
of the sanctions, you mean?
Right, and design the sanctions for each level, customize
mm-hmm.
it for each level. And the offenders, they get classified based on their criminal history, totally based on their record of how they've behaved in the past. And we also do it off charges, because what we found in the study is some of these guys would get 3 and 4 charges before the first one was convicted or even heard. So a new charge is an indication that you did not heed the message, and it'll bring action from us.
And it doesn't have to be a felony charge either, right? It could be a minor charge. It's still a charge?
Anything. We even Anything? Tell them quite plainly that any charge, we will seek any charge if they don't listen to their notice, if they do a future act or a prohibited behavior. Even if it's not a charge, if he's stalking or he's harassing, phone calling, we will make any charge. And in addition to that, because they've got these rich criminal histories, we're probably able to try something else that he's got pending.
Like
for
a traffic stop? What if he,
exactly.
what if he runs a red light? Red
we
light?
Told him. We told him we'd give you the Al Capone. We're going to give you the Al Capone treatment if you don't listen. We had another guy. He had 2 larcenies pending. And he was intimidating his victim, and we knew it. And she was too shaky for court, so the district attorney did his 2 larceny charges and did them back-to-back and got him about 18 months on shoplifting charges, active time,
Ooh.
Which you never get, and mm-hmm. told him, "This is you're getting this specifically because of what you did to this victim over here." And after he went to jail, He calls her from the jail and threatens her. We took out a new charge on him and got him additional time, and then she was willing to testify. So, yeah, we tell them clearly, you get the Al Capone treatment. If we can't get you for what you did to that victim, we'll get you for something else.
Oh, wow, that's wonderful. And it buys you time, right?
Right. I mean, these victims need time. They need time. And he needs to know that there will be a consequence if he don't stop. And we've gone to great lengths to make sure that we can do that. And it's there. It was all there. We didn't create any new laws.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do anything extrajudicial. We use the system as it exists and make it work like it's supposed to for the victim and to hold the offender accountable.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. How many more people did you have to hire in order to, like, monitor all of these people and do all the daily, you know, extra work and all of that? Is it, quote-unquote, costing you more money on one end, but then on the other end you're reaping such good results that it's worth it? I mean, did you have to go to the legislature in North Carolina or to, you know, somebody in government to say, hey, we need, you know, this grant to implement this because we need more officers?
I'm happy to report that it did not require us to get any additional funding.
Really?
And I did not get any additional personnel.
Wow.
We committed two detectives that used to do a variety of cases, but just simply two detectives are the ones that review the records and get the notice. And we trained the patrol officers how to deliver the letters and gave them a script. And our theory was, this was our number one call for service, but more than 5,000 a year. They averaged 26 minutes, so it was like 6,000 man hours every year we were already spending on this. If we reduce repeat calls or reduce victimization, we're going to get that time back. And turned out that was true. Last year we had, for the first year, we had 1,000 fewer calls than we did the year before. So that's a massive amount of time saving. And think about, you know, wow, you took a detective away. Yeah, but that's a bunch of assaults and a bunch of assaults with a deadly weapon cases that you don't have to investigate either. So,
right.
Well, we wanted to make sure that whatever we did, we could do it with existing resources, because if there's any value to it for other people to replicate it, it can't be dependent upon a grant or a lot of money. You got to be able to do it with what you got.
Right, because police departments don't have extra resources and a lot of money. I mean, maybe a lot of people don't know that, but, yeah, they really don't. Isn't that true?
That's true,
and
especially through the last 5 years.
Well, and not only that, but look how many cuts have been made across the board for resources in domestic violence shelter systems and agencies. Everybody's been hurting money-wise. But does it complement or take the place of traditional offender programs, for instance, anger management or drug and alcohol programs that are mandated? Are these still being used, or are they not needed?
It's built in, isn't
our it? Our better intervention program is alive and well. And, you know, we have about, you know, 12 people per group. We have groups in two cities. I think there's a total of seven. In High Point, we have two groups. And the court orders, if you've been charged with assault on a female and you're on probation, I hope I got that right, Chief Sumner, that you will be court ordered to a better intervention program. And that's a North Carolina thing.
And that has been ongoing for years, and that is part of the sanction at the lowest level of this scale.
Mm-hmm.
This complements, and I'll tell you, I got a call from the president of the National Anger Management Association and said he heard about this and read something and said, much to his surprise, what we do is very similar to what they do with the individuals in the classes. He said, you're doing citywide what we do with an individual as far as how it's laid out. So he said that it complements it very, very well.
It does.
It's interesting. Wow. So at the lower level, I mean, if you have a substance abuse problem or, you know, or something like that. That is incorporated in into the program that, that the court is going to order. It's not like any of that goes away, right?
Right.
That's correct. Usually, when they come into the Batterer Intervention Program, we do a full assessment. So any mental health issues, any diagnoses that they might bring in or any substance use issues that they bring in,
right.
those things are assessed for, and then we refer back to the appropriate treatment for that, and then they also complete the group while they're doing, which is actually beneficial too, because the group is meant to say violence is not the way this is, needs to work out. That's the point of the group, and to kind of sort of attach, approach it in a way of, you know, this is not how you solve problems. This is not the way you're going to, you know, be with your intimate partner. And so to have the mental health support and the substance abuse support that's concurrent with the batter intervention treatment is very useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Shane, this might be a good opportunity. I know you wanted to make the point that and I don't know if I'm phrasing it correctly, that, you know, especially if it's multi-generational and you're in the cycle of violence and it starts out with slapping someone and your level of tolerance, it's you're almost immune to that, and you think in the beginning, oh, that's okay, I can handle that. But didn't you want to talk about what you think is a very powerful message with regard to that?
Well, I think our society gets very desensitized to violence. So a lot of
right.
times, if you do have a family of origin that there was domestic violence, or, you know, child physical abuse, child sexual abuse, all of those family of origin things that everybody comes from, you know, it's a certain level of violence is okay. And we see things in the paper all the time and that says, well, I'd only seen him push her. Well, that's not okay just to push her. So, you know, and then all of a sudden there's a homicide. So family members may not even register that pushing her or taking her keys or preventing her from leaving a room is a huge red flag to any escalating behaviors that might be happening. And I think we get very desensitized to the idea
mm-hmm.
that there's this spectrum of violence. And so what may be why I call today is that, you know, he broke my arm, whereas actually what it has been is that he's been pushing and shoving me and holding me down for the past 3 months. And so I made the phone call because he broke my arm. And that's the thing that I think people don't realize, is that if he's going to push her in front of a family member, what is he doing in private?
Right.
And very recently, I actually just came back from vacation, and I was in another city, and I saw a domestic violence incident play out while I was on vacation, and he was in her face, and I thought, if he's doing this in a grocery store,
mm-hmm.
what is he doing at home? And everybody sort of walked by, and I ended up actually because he had grabbed her and was pulling her out of the store, and I'd actually called the police. I don't know if they responded or not. I don't know what what actually the end of the story that was, but I went ahead and called the police because I felt like that was going to escalate, and it was going to escalate in a place that we weren't going to see it.
Wow.
And,
yeah,
you know, I didn't want her to be in danger.
Great. And I think I know where you went. Oh, my goodness. I hope the police did something. That's exactly what everybody needs to do. And I hope you identified yourself as, you know, what you do for a living, because maybe they would have taken it more seriously. But I think how do we change attitudes with respect to that, if it's cyclical and, oh, you know, my grandmother got pushed and so it's no big deal. How do we change that, Chief, or both of you? Combined with this program, don't we have to – is this helping to change – behavior significantly too, you know, going forward?
I think so. 2 years ago, we started a very public awareness program around this to make sure that people understood this is wrong. We, with the help of Susan Herman, developed this message for these offenders. Part I haven't told you about is for the offenders who have the worst records, they get a full face-to-face notification. They have to, they're compelled to come to City Hall. They have to sit and listen to two-part message, community and law enforcement, and they're told. And this is a meeting where public, we invite members of the public to come as well, and they're told violence, domestic violence is wrong. And the community is saying no, and there's no excuse for domestic violence. And if you think nobody cares, that's wrong. And if you think it's secret, it's not. And we talk to them about the cost to the community and family. And then the law enforcement comes into the room right after that, and I tell them that, and it's, I've got all my partners there and the district attorneys, and I tell them, look, any offense is going to bring special attention. You cannot stand. And it's not driven by the victim. This is plainly done out. And these are the guys that are the worst. Their records are very similar to the ones who committed homicides in High Point. Three or more violations, convicted felons, acts of violence in their past, both domestic and not. So you would think, or most people would not believe that that group could be deterred simply by a face-to-face message. But we've conducted four of those. We've had 53 gentlemen sitting in that chairs, and we've convicted four of those in 2 years, and we've only had three of those guys reoffend after that night. So they can be deterred. If they don't have a mental health problem, they are rational, and they can be deterred when it's clearly laid out for them.
And is it like a scared straight kind of a meeting?
It's not scared straight because it's not worth threatening them. It's giving them information to make the right choice and making sure they understand you're no longer anonymous. We know who you are. We've already reviewed your record. I give them a letter saying we've already looked at your record. If you get a new offense for assault on a female, here's the sentence you're going to get. These guys have no idea what kind of time or what kind of risk they're at for a new offense, and we lay it out in a letter for them. So they walk away knowing exactly what's going to be done, and it's not going to be driven by her. And some of these guys don't even remember everything they've done. That's why we put it in a letter after the first call-in.
Right.
They don't remember, you know, if they didn't pull any jail time for it, they didn't think it counted, and they don't even remember everything. So we lay it out for them in writing. But that meeting right there has, we have gotten a couple of hundred people come to that every time. Segments of the community, I can see where people are changing their awareness level, and they're calling us when they didn't call before because now they know something real is going to happen.
It's almost like a public hearing. You invite the public to come and witness and be part of that.
They do. They do come.
Wow. That now when you say
well, it's
you,
also
you give
one of
them
the
letter,
one of the things that the public is seeing that you're taking domestic violence seriously, where in the past it's been, you know, kind of overlooked. It wasn't a serious crime, so to speak. It was kind of
a family
affair. Yeah, family matter. Let them deal with it, and we'll just walk away and leave them alone. So it's just refreshing to see this happening.
And I'll tell you the direct benefit of that. One gentleman approached me in the gym while we were working out, and he said, you know, I saw that on TV about how you guys are really focused on domestic violence. He said, I'm going to tell you, there's a lady at the bank, and I've noticed she's had bruising several times, and I could just pretty well be sure that something's happening, and I know you'll look into it, so I'm going to tell you where she works and everything. Those are the things we never heard before.
Wow.
And they're bringing
that's
it to
great.
Us.
Can you tell us proportionately how many of the couples tend to stay together versus separate and don't have problems? I mean, is there data on that you're keeping?
We are, Shane, you know.
I would say, anecdotally speaking, I would say most people stay together. Or when I say stay together, most people are going to continue contact. And that's one of the things that I've been working with my staff on is because of this initiative, like Chief Sumner said, the idea of them not having contact is just really not – it's just not going to happen. And particularly if there's children involved.
Children, yeah.
It's just – yeah, because, I mean, at the end of the day, he is the father of her children. The court may order contact with the children. There's going to have to be visitation. There's going to have to be, you know, child support and all those kind of things that play into it. So you know, what I really tried to work with my staff on is to work with her on safety planning. You know, she knows him better than any of us do. She's been able to survive for however many years she's been with him. So there's some strengths in that. And so what we try to do is really safety plan with her. And just to add a word on that, a lot of times when we safety plan with a victim, that's the first time they may even realize how much danger they might actually be in, because nobody's ever said, hey, can we make a safety plan with you? And so that helps her work through, you know, how do I notify a neighbor if something's going on? You know, where do I leave my important documents? Do I need a suitcase that's packed and ready? And all of those things that would help her make that quick escape if things do escalate. So that being said, my advocates are, that's really where we are. We really try never to approach in judgment of, are you leaving or are you staying? We're going to meet them where they are, and we're going to safety plan with them accordingly, and to give them the information they need. They can come back to us at any time. We have a support group that meets weekly that they can enter and exit as they see fit or as the need arises. We have a 24/7 crisis line. They can call anytime and get support and help and emotional support. So we really do wrap those services around them. And if they choose to stay, we just want them to have the information that they need to be safe and to keep their kids safe.
Right. Well, I think your program, along with Susan's evidentiary abuse affidavit, would be a perfect marriage, and hopefully we could get you that information. Perhaps you could use it as a as an additional tool. I'm just
Absolutely.
Throwing that out there as a possibility. I think it would be great, don't you, Jalila?
It's on its way.
All right.
I read the website thoroughly.
You did?
Good.
After we
I did.
Talked?
I did.
Oh, my God. See that?
Can
That's
I add something
wonderful.
For the
Thank
victims?
You.
Let me have, can I have one more thing that came out of this for the victims?
Ahead.
There's two other things that were put in place.
Yeah.
With her permission, we would cocoon her, and that simply means she would identify somebody close to her that would know if she's in trouble that we could communicate with. And the other thing was, we called it proximity informant. If people around you, you tell them what to look for, what won't look right, and we have already had one lady who told her neighbor, the neighbor noticed her car didn't leave for work, the neighbor called the police, and we get to the house, and he had broken into the house and was holding her at gunpoint, and already taken some pictures and told her he was going to kill her, and it took the SWAT team about an hour to talk him out of there, but she emerged, you know, naturally alive is better than, you know, what she was going through was terrible, but if that had not been put in place and we didn't get that call, he surely would have killed her.
Wow.
So those two things are something that we added to this, which is important for the victims. But,
and
I'd
have
be remiss.
To add just... Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry,
Chief. I just
have
to tell you about the change in homicides.
Yeah. I saw some of your data. Go ahead and tell us.
Briefly, 5 years before we started this, we had 17 domestic-related homicides. In the 5 years since we begun, and I say five because we started working on the worst of the worst in late 2009, early 2010, in those 5 years we've only had one domestic-related homicide. So it went from 17 to 1.
17 to 1. That's true,
and,
man. I mean,
and in
tremendous.
This county we're in, our county was the highest county for domestic homicides last year in the entire state. So I think that our intervention is really working. That.
Well, it really sounds it. Are you, I mean, this really begs the question, at what point, I mean, you said you've done marketing and whatnot, and I know you said you've done presentations and people are calling you, the National Anger Management. How are you trying to share this with the world or even next door in South Carolina, say, where their problems are so tremendous there as well? What is your plan for the future with regard to trying to get other people to join the bandwagon, so to speak?
We have made multiple presentations at conferences. We have trained several agencies who sent teams here to do this, and we have personally mentored the first department to replicate it, Lexington Police in North Carolina. We trained them and mentored them through, and they went, yes, they went live July 1. And so we're going to track their experience as well. And we have really created a new general order. That's how police departments order how officers respond to calls. And we now have one that describes how this work is done, and pretty much we could send that out at some point in time with some literature with it, and people could adopt it.
I'm so impressed. It's tremendous. I'm so glad.
I agree. It's just so refreshing to see something new coming down the pike and developed in this way it's just actually flipping it. It's going proactive instead of being reactive to what's going on in the whole realm of domestic violence.
Yeah, it is. It's really very impressive.
You know,
before we run out of time, I
have one last question. The way that we talk, and this is very common when we speak about domestic violence, and because of the fact that it is usually male perpetrators and female victims. However, what type of resources have you come across for male victims? I hear this all the time. You know, there's not enough resources for male victims, and they're not reporting.
Well, they probably aren't reporting for lots of cultural and, you know, just cultural reasons. But as far as Family Services of the Piedmont goes, we do shelter male victims, and we would provide any of the same services to a male victim that we would provide to a female victim. And that we do have male victims. It happens pretty frequently. And one of the other parts of this conversation is the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender population.
Yes.
That we provide the same services that we would provide anybody else. And that's a big thing for me as Director of Victim Services in Guilford County, that I want whoever needs the service to be able to access it. And to be able to have a meaningful interaction and get the things that they need, and the education and all those kinds of things. So as far as male victims go, we would provide the same service. But I just want to add one thing, because this is strictly from a victim service point of view, and I think historically victim advocates in my career, I've met many, many victim advocates across the state and the country that really do not see law enforcement as a solution to much of anything. And I think that's very unfortunate, because I think the partnership with victim advocacy and law enforcement is rich in opportunity. And I think, you know, historically we may have missed out on some of the opportunities that we could have had. So to be able to partner and to have this open dialogue with our local law enforcement, High Point Police Department, is something that is a huge opportunity for us, and we're very grateful for it. And I think it does absolutely nothing but benefit the city of High Point. So I wanted to extend that to Chief Sumner, and just to say that as a victim service provider, don't collaborate with your local law enforcement. It's a very good thing.
Yeah, would you say that also about the court personnel too there?
Yes.
I mean, have they
absolutely
been very open and receptive?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, our district attorney's office, we work very closely with those community partners. We would not be half as effective at what we do without being able to communicate with them. And I'll tell you what it looks like is when I have a victim and I say, you know, my friend Jerry can help us out, and I can give him a call, and that's one of the detectives, and he comes in, and we can sit down and talk about it. It really does eliminate all of that feeling about law enforcement, because it's an approach that meets the victim where they are, It really is a very rich partnership in the community with all the agencies coming together.
It does sound wonderful. And before we do run out of time, I want to extend this invitation. You both know very well that October is Domestic Violence National Domestic Violence Month. Would you consider coming back for a show in October to continue the conversation?
Absolutely.
Sure. Be glad
okay.
To.
consider
Put them on the
invitation
schedule, Donna.
Extended. What?
I said get them on the schedule.
I know. And, hey, maybe I'll call you up. I'm going to be in Myrtle Beach in a couple weeks. Maybe we can plan something, okay?
Right on.
We will do that. You know, and who knows? I'm so inspired. Maybe I'll even write a blog, which I don't know. If I have time, we'll see tomorrow. But, I'm so grateful for this, and I know Delilah is. This has been a wonderful hour, and I'm hoping that we can share it with the world. You're doing wonderful things. Chief, keep up the good work. Shay, keep up the good work. And we're going to have to say a good evening for now, but be sure to listen on the archives, and who knows, maybe watch for something else from me, and we'll continue the conversation definitely next month. So thank you, Chief. Thank you, Shay and Delilah, and we'll say good evening for Shattered Lives. Listen,
Mommy said it's our secret.
Who will believe me? I'm just a kid.
If I'm good and behave myself, everything will be okay.
Daddy works so hard, we have to help him by being good.
If my friends found out, I would die of embarrassment.
A child in an abusive household can feel helpless and without a voice. Learn to notice the signs and speak for them.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.